All right, Steve Lamb, alcoholic. Again, it's good to be here. It's really good to be sober. I want to thank all you gentlemen for me what has been a really fantastic retreat. So I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope you've gotten something out of it. Just so you know, because I know a lot of people are packed up and they're getting ready to move out, and you know, we've had a lot of spirituality over the weekend, and we'd like to, I'm sure, for the people that are leaving, be able to compress that, because people have things to do. They need to get down the hill, right? I mean, this is reality, right? This is the world. But just give me a little bit more time. I'm going to ask you to consider just a couple of things before you take yourself down the hill. And the first session won't be as long as the prior sessions, and the second session will be quite short, just so you know. But the first session, I'd like to begin by, I'm going to ask you to indulge me one more time, and try to sit up kind of straight in your chair, square your shoulders, and have both feet on the floor. Relax your hands, relax your shoulders. And what I'm going to ask you to do is we're going to do a 5-minute meditation to get this started. And it's going to be based on something we've talked about this weekend. So go ahead and take a nice deep breath through your nose and release it through your mouth. And now do it one more time and really, really feel the air move out of your chest. Now what I'm going to ask you to do, gentlemen, is to shut your eyes and visualize the circle of life that we have talked about that Chuck Chamberlain had in his talks in Palo Mesa, and that's in the book, A New Pair of Glasses. So just see this circle. And visualize that inside the circle are all the people, plants, animals, rocks, everything in the universe is inside this circle of life. Now put whatever your concept of a higher power or God is inside the circle of life. To the side of the circle of life, I want you in your mind's eye to draw a line. And that line is ego. That line is conscious separation from God. Next to that line, please draw a stick man. That stick man is you. That stick man is me. Now, as you focus on the circle of life and you see the line that appears to separate you and me from the circle of life, I want you in your mind's eye to erase that line. Obliterate that line. Now I want you in your mind's eye to move that stick man, me and you, inside the circle of life. Okay, gentlemen, the second to last session is going to focus principally on carrying the message and practicing the principles in all our affairs. And we're going to just cover a few parting thoughts that I have for your consideration as you go about your life. But before we get into that, I want to talk briefly about the concept of, and I'm sure everybody's heard this in meetings, act as if. And sometimes you'll hear the phrase, fake it till you make it. When I was new and I heard the phrase, fake it till you make it, it just pissed me off. Because here I got people telling me we've got to practice rigorous honesty, and then I got other people telling me I got to fake it till I make it. How can I practice rigorous honesty if I fake it till I make it? And I'm going to submit to you that act as if is different than fake it till you make it. Little story. When I was newly sober, I had maybe a little over a year, maybe 2 years of sobriety, and I went up to visit my sister Vic in Sun Valley, Idaho. And my sister knew that I was an alcoholic, and she knew I was in the program, and her significant other at the time, a guy named John, had been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for several years before I got here. So he was excited to see me when I got up to Sun Valley, and he took me to some meetings. And at a lot of these meetings, he would share, and he would keep saying, you know, I'm just faking it till I make it. I'm going to fake it till I make it. I'm going to fake it till I make it. And that was just a common phrase, at least that I heard up in Sun Valley. You know, and I'm relatively new, but I'd been taught that, you know, when you go to another place, you know, don't step on their buzz, whatever they're doing, they're happy with it. It's not what I was accustomed to, and it felt weird, but it's none of my business. So I just went to the meetings, and I didn't say anything. In 1999, my mom, for the second time, contracted cancer and was getting ready to die. She'd had breast cancer before. She'd had both breasts removed. For 15 years, she'd been cancer-free, but now a spot had appeared near her liver by her spine. It had entered her bloodstream. It had metastasized. And we pretty much knew that she only had maybe 6 to 9 months to live. And this was in April of 1999. So I started going out to Vegas and seeing her every 2 or 3 weeks and hanging out with her. And towards the end of the year, she was being visited by hospice care, and the way that this works for people with cancer, some of you I'm sure know, is they tend to be alert and awake less each day. So they go from an 8-hour, 10-hour day down to 6, down to 5, down to 4, and she was down to around 4 hours a day, and this is Christmas time of 1999. So my family's all gathered together, and where people are out from Michigan, and my sister and John are down from Idaho, and we're going to have our traditional pre-Christmas dinner, which is spaghetti. It doesn't make any sense, but that's what we do. We're cooking spaghetti, and everybody's around the kitchen table, and we're, you know, throwing spaghetti noodles against the wall to see if they stick, and we're, you know, cooking up basically the meatballs and the sauce, and, you know, my mom is laughing. She's over on the couch in the corner, and my sister is helping cook, and so is John. And my sister, who's not an alcoholic, is drinking a glass of wine. No big deal, but so is John. Now, I've been to AA with John, but I've been told, you know, hey, it's none of my business. He's drinking wine, right? So he's drinking wine, and I noticed that as my sister drinks the wine, she'll put her wine glass down, and she'll forget where it is. Not John. John's got that wine glass cup to his hand the whole time, and if it starts to get empty, he fills it to the top. He's always holding the, I mean, I don't care if he's stirring the dude. He's got that wine glass, and he's holding the wine glass. You know, and I'm watching him. Watching him, right? But I'm not saying anything, right? And then John, you know, he can tell I'm a little disturbed by this. He says, hey, it's okay. You know, I've gone to the doctor, and I've found that I've got a chemical imbalance. The doctor's given me some medication, and I'm okay now. So I'm not an alcoholic. I can drink. And I said, really? The doctor told you that? He goes, well, no, the doctor didn't exactly tell me that. See? And, you know, and he went with his whole story. And by the way, this is not an indictment whatsoever on medication. The problem is that he decided to self-diagnose himself as not an alcoholic because he'd been acting as if, and apparently he thought he'd overcompensated, that he didn't really need to do that. So I called my sponsor, you know, I said, hey, Michael, you know, John's drinking. And he's like, hey, that's none of your business. That's none of your business. Okay, if he needs help, he'll ask for it, and you're supposed to be there. And by the way, you really haven't made amends to your sister yet. So, you know... something might come up here where, you know, you might need to make amends to your sister. So I'm watching. And my stepdad, whom I also call dad, because I really lived with him the majority of my life, I can't remember, but we had to go get something from the store. So we're driving, and my dad's, you know, he's passed away now, but he was old then, and he had a tendency, sometimes old people, no offense, Pacey, but, you know, they see the stop sign, and they, did I say that out loud? Okay, and they see the stop sign, and they don't stop before the stop sign. They stop, like, 2 feet after the stop sign, right? You're like, hey, Dad, you know, I mean, either blow it or just stop, you know, whatever, right? And he stops. He's got, like, 2 feet sticking out into the intersection. He turns and looks at me. He goes, you know, you don't just have a chemical imbalance. You know that, right? And I said, Dad, I'm an alcoholic. I got it. Don't worry about it. I mean, that's okay. So we go to the store. We do our business. And, you know, everything's fine. We go back, and we have Christmas. It's good. And, you know, John doesn't have any escapades or nothing really happens. But he's drinking pretty heavy. About a month or so later, my mom passes away, and I do the service, and it was great, and my sister was here, and then everything's okay, and then my sister goes back up to Idaho. I think it was maybe 3 months, maybe 4 months after Christmas, sometime maybe the March or April time frame, I got a phone call about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and many of us have had these phone calls, and the person on the other end of the line is you know, they're crying and they're sobbing, and I can just hear the snot flowing. And I finally realize it's my sister. And I'm like, Vic, what's wrong? And what she told me was that John had found it necessary to take a handgun and put it in his mouth and blow his brains out in the living room while they were in the next room. And he's dead. And I said, Vic, I'm so sorry. You know, the only thing that I can tell you is if he's an alcoholic of my variety, this isn't about him. This isn't about you, and this isn't about my niece, okay? This is about alcoholism, okay? And I told her, I said, look, you know, and I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, but I know a bunch of people. They're in this organization called Al-Anon. I don't know what the deal is, but they follow us pretty much everywhere we go. They got their eyes on us all the time. And I know people who know people. And basically, I hooked her up with Al-Anon so that she could get some recovery. And one of the things that this taught me is that acting as if is different from fake it till you make it. And fake it till you make it can be terminal. Now, the concept of act as if is frequently heard at AA meetings, but it's nowhere in the big book. It doesn't appear in the big book anywhere. It's not in the basic text, and it's not in 12 steps and 12 traditions. But it is in the only text that's referenced in the big book, and that's a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience, which is written by a guy named William James. And in The Varieties of Religious Experience, at page 52, James says, our conceptions always require a sense content to work with. And as the words soul, God, immortality cover no distinctive sense content whatever, it follows that, theoretically speaking, they are words devoid of any significance. Yet, strangely enough, they have a definite meaning for our practice. We can act as if there were a God. So there's a difference between acting as if there were a God and fake it till you make it. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity says, the rule for us is perfectly simple. Do not waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor. Act as if you did. As soon as we do this, we find one of the great secrets. When you are behaving as if you loved someone, you will presently come to love him. Now, is there a background for this in the big book? There is, actually, in one of the fourth edition stories called Tightrope. But probably the closest analogy to this in the big book is on page 14, where Bill says, my friend, and he's referring to Ebby, had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And we talked earlier about this concept of faith without works, that faith without works in the context of Alcoholics Anonymous seems to imply and require a certain degree of action. It's not just sitting around thinking about or believing something. In the story Tightrope, which is on page 366 of the big book, This is written by a guy who's trying to navigate separate worlds. He's a gay alcoholic. He's a little confused. He's finally landed in AA. And he writes, he, meaning my sponsor, suggested that for me, a good starting point would simply be recognition of the fact that I had failed in running the world. In short, acceptance of the fact that I was not God. He also suggested that I might try occasionally to act as if I believed. Somewhere I had heard that it is easier to act yourself into a new way of thinking than to think yourself into a new way of acting. And this made sense in the context of acting as if. So a lot of times we come in and we don't have a belief. I didn't have a belief because I didn't have the experience yet. But I was asked to have faith, which requires action, and to act as if certain of these things were true. And then based on my experience, they became true. Now, one of the things that we talked about in terms of carrying the message was, do you have to give it away to keep it? I mean, we hear this a lot in meetings. Do you even have it if you're not giving it away? What is it? Is it 1 through 11 or is it 1 through 12? Because if it's 1 through 12, you have to be giving it away to even get it in the first instance. The source for this that appears to me, when you hear this, you know, you have to give it away to keep it, is probably from Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, pages 128 and 129, the reference to the gaunt prospector. And in the book, in the story, the family afterward, the chapter of the family afterward, Bill writes, like a gaunt prospector, belt drawn in over the last ounce of food, our pick struck gold. Joy at our release from a lifetime of frustration knew no bounds. Father feels he has struck something better than gold. For a time, he may try to hug the new treasure to himself. He may not see at once that he has barely scratched a limitless lode, which will pay dividends only if he mines it for the rest of his life and insists on giving away the entire product. Now, the key here is he's already struck gold. He's already mining it, okay? And he needs to continue to give it away. In A Vision for You on page 164, we're told, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. So until you start giving it away, you haven't got it. We talked earlier in 12 and 12, in the 12 and 12 on page 57, where it says, until we had talked with complete candor of our conflicts and had listened to someone else do the same thing, we still didn't belong. We still didn't see ourselves in that circle of life with everybody else. So we go through this process and we listen to inventory. And what happens when we listen to inventory? What happens when we listen to a fifth step? My experience is I see God through the eyes of the sponsee that's telling me his deepest, darkest secrets that he said he would never tell anybody. And I got to tell you, I've had some moments sublime when I've done meditation, but every time I've listened to a fifth step, I've had that experience. And that's the experience that Chamberlain talks about. It's that union. It's that conscious contact. In certain of the Eastern religions, it's referred to as non-duality or Advaita. You know, it's this understanding that we're not separate. Even though we think we're separate, we're not separate. That to me is one of the true values of sponsorship. Like I've said, to me, this is the divine distraction. It gets me out of self and it gets me into God. Now, everybody that sponsored anybody has had one of the phone calls that I referred to earlier, where, you know, the guy's calling, he doesn't really care how you're doing because he needs to talk about him. Because what's going on with him is centermost in his mind. And even though in the big book he's read that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem, he can't see it because he's in the midst of that delusion and he wants relief and he's looking to you to get relief. And he calls you, and the person that really principally gets the relief is the sponsor. Because the sponsor invariably might be having a hard time with the wife or the husband or the boyfriend or the girlfriend or the dog or the cat or work or whatever, and now a sponsee is called, and their life's on the line. And even though it seems like a relatively trivial problem, we focus our attention on it, and what happens? We start to not think about ourselves. We get out of self, and we get into God. So what happens? You know, what happens there? To me, that's a magical, mystical experience. And these guys get sober, and we fall in love with them. And we try our best to be patient and tolerant and loving and helpful without becoming, like Scott said, the psychotic participant. And some days I succeed, and some days I don't. You know, because these people that I sponsor, these men that I sponsor, mean a lot to me. They're part of my life. When we talk about the design for living, they're in that design. They're interwoven into the fabric of my life. They're what I do. They're who I am. They've become a part of me. And what happens is they call, and just like when I would call my sponsor, you know, generally the answer is to pray and meditate and ask for direction. My sponsor was very direct, but he was never really directive. You know, very, very rarely did he tell me what to do. There were times where he said, "Really? That's your plan? That's it? Seriously? You know, I want you to say that again and tell me if you really think that sounds reasonable." And it used to piss me off because it seemed like a seemingly brilliant plan when I had formulated it. But once I articulated it to him, it seemed really, really stupid, you know? And I'm not sure how that works, but that's one of the processes. And one of the things that happened to me is I told you that a lot of the guys that I first sponsored, they, you know, they got sober and everything went well. And the first guy that I sponsored, Stephen, the guy who has the son with cerebral palsy, Evan, after 2.5, almost 3 years of really good sobriety and frankly, excellent sponsorship on my part, you know, he went out. He drank again. And I'll tell you that my first thought was concerned for him, but it was followed almost immediately by, "Oh man, this guy's gonna make me look bad. What's with that? I had to write inventory on that." That's the whole spiritual pride thing, right? And he would, you know, I tried to keep the door open. I tried to stand by the door. He would call me. He's just drunk, you know, and I wouldn't, you know, talk to him a lot, but I would take his calls. This went on for 5 years. And I remember I talked to a guy. I said, "What do I do? You know, I feel like I should go over and get him." He said, "Well, you can't get him sober. We can't get him sober. You know, they have to take certain action. The best thing you can do is, you know, don't be a dick, be nice to the guy, and leave it open." But it was painful, you know, because he's got kids. I know he's driving drunk with the kids in the car. I mean, it's dangerous, right? And I know this guy really, really well. Really well, because I've listened to a detailed fifth step from this guy, and I've listened to 10 steps from him for several months. This goes on for about 5 years, and then you know, finally he comes back in, and I sponsor him again. Now he's got over 10 years. And what I'm clear on is that I didn't do that. I didn't do that. A lot of times people will talk about, you know, sponsorship, like you really got to find the perfect sponsor. I don't know that there's such a thing. My belief is that if you all stick to the black part of the book and you do the best and you go through it and you try to follow the directions in the book, that's really good sponsorship. Okay? It's pretty clear. It's pretty detailed. Where we have problems is where we deviate from that. I also would tell you that at least from, you know, what I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, we do not fire sponsees. I don't do it. Do they annoy me? At times, yes. Have I written inventory on sponsees? Yes, many times, okay? But I don't fire them. I will, on the other hand, accept a resignation, okay? You know, sometimes, and that's only happened once, and he claims that I fired him. I believe that I accepted the resignation, and I'm sponsoring him again. So they're kind of, you know, they're kind of like dingleberries on your butt. They're hard to brush off. You know, it's just one of these things. And, you know, and I love these guys. And a lot of the guys that I sponsor have less time than me, and there's a few that have more time than me. And one of the guys, the guy who has the most time, he's been sober 29 years. And he was sponsored by Scott Redmond. And his name is John. He's a great guy. He sponsors a ton of guys. And he asked me to sponsor him simply because we speak the same language. You know, he read inventory to me while Scott was sick, and I understand that, and I can listen. And one of the things that that's taught me is my job is often more times just to listen and to try to point out things that maybe they don't see. Like my sponsor did for me when he pointed out to me that I had essentially become like my father. And that's a big part of sponsorship to me. And, you know, you'll look in the book and you'll hear a lot about, you know, I had a hard-hearted sponsor, you know, I needed a sponsor louder than my head. I'm not going to argue with any of that. I just don't see any of that in the big book. You know, Scott Redmond used to say, look, nobody can do me like I can do me. I don't need you to beat me up. You know, I need a sponsor. You know, I don't need a thug. We joke around a lot about spiritual warfare, but when we talk about a channel, we mean a channel, not an instrument, not one that can be wielded. And I've had people that have come to me and that have said, look, I just want you to tell me what to do and when to do it, and I won't do it. Do I think I probably know better for them what to do than they do? Probably I do. Why don't I do it? I can't afford it. The book says that I'm not God. If I'm not God for me, I can't be God for you. You know, I have to really embrace that. I have to understand that we're all in the circle of life and that we're all brothers and that, you know, I love my sponsor dearly. But he's got warts and blemishes just like I do. Every alcoholic I've ever met does. Like I said, you know, if you're going to go to Catalina and you're alcoholic, you're going to take the boat or you're going to take the plane. Nobody's walking on the water. It doesn't work that way. I want to talk briefly about practicing the principles. And the reason why I want to talk about practicing the principles is because a lot of times there's an emphasis on carrying the message. Like, that's the 12th step. Well, there's at least two parts to the 12th step, and one of them is practicing the principles in all our affairs. And if you think about it, we're going to spend, I don't care how active you are in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to spend more time doing that or not doing that than you are carrying the message in any given day. That's just the reality of it, okay? And this is where we talk about how we treat our husbands, our wives, our girlfriends, our boyfriends, the dog, the cat, you know, the person that's at the grocery store, all of this stuff. And I remember when I was new, one of the complaints that I had was it seemed like all the guys around me were, the jobs were getting back, they were getting back together with their wives and the kids, everything was going really well. And I was complaining. And I got to confess to you that I used to refer to my wife as the malcontented bitch from hell. I did. I know. That's not very nice. It's not very kind. And it's not accurate. It's not accurate. Because like I said, that was my delusion. My delusion is, hey, Ma, ain't it grand? The wind stopped blowing. I've been sober 3 months. Let's do this thing. She's looking at me like, yeah, okay, that's good. I'm watching you. Keep doing what you're doing. And I'm like, hey, I've done it. I've arrived. So she's looking at it from a totally different perspective than I am. And I was complaining to Michael about this. And by the way, this, you know, I referred to as the malcontented bitch from hell. She referred to me as the dick with ears. So there was just, you know, it was. Now, I was not accurate. She was quite on point. She was quite accurate. So I'm complaining to Michael about the family afterward. And he's, you know, he's a bit, not as sarcastic as I am, but he's a bit sarcastic. So he grabs the book and he goes, oh, the family afterward. You want the family afterward, huh? Okay, well, let's see where that is in the book. Well, it looks like it's after How It Works. It looks like it's after Into Action. You know, it looks like it's after Working With Others. And it looks like it's after To Wives. It looks like it's after a whole bunch of stuff that you haven't done yet. And that's the reality. I mean, one of the things, if you think about it, if you've been around a while, it seems to me that I get well and act well. I act as if first inside the rooms. You know, I'm no longer the guy that comes in and the old timers tell me, hey, just sit in the back and don't talk to the newcomers. You know, I'm actually an active participant in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sponsoring people. I'm being sponsored. I'm working the steps. I'm praying and meditating. I'm in the game. And then I get better at work. And lastly, and pathetically, I get better at home. Why is that? I don't know exactly, but it seems to follow within the chronology laid out in the book, number one, number two. And it seems to me that, you know, if you're in my family, if you're my wife, I've got an expectation. that rapidly turns into a demand. That demand is unfulfilled. That goes right into a resentment. And that happens a lot quicker than a newcomer or somebody at the meeting. You know, like I said, I can sit there and listen to a newcomer. I'll put everything down, but my wife calls and I'm multitasking. What's with that? Now, that's where I think when we're talking about practicing the principles in all our affairs, that takes, my experience is, that takes a lot of work. That's why in the big book it says there's a long period of reconstruction ahead on page 83. It also says the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. What does that mean? That we have to engage with these people and we have to treat them as they're supposed to be treated. Now, this is for me and for a lot of us, this is difficult. So what happens? You know, I got family problems, you know. Things aren't going well with my wife. I get Stephen as a sponsee. He starts talking to me about his wife, and I'm thinking, oh my God, that's horrific. I can't even believe that. Now, I'm not telling him to stay or leave, but I'm thinking, man, I'd be out of there like, you know, in a Texas heartbeat. I couldn't tolerate that. And then I go home and see my wife, and you know, she doesn't look that bad. Things are pretty good. It's not as bad as I thought it was. A few years later, you know, and things get resolved with me and my wife through sponsoring Stephen. A few years later, my sponsor's wife, Christy, is sharing at a meeting. I think she had 11 or 12 years or something. She took a birthday cake. And she said that she used to be very pleased and very happy when she would see me walking up the steps to their house to do step work. Because during that time period, and I was totally unaware of it, Michael and she were going through some serious marital difficulties, and they thought that they were going to separate or get divorced. But she knew that when I came in and talked about my marriage, that they'd be okay for at least another week. Yeah. So then Stephen gets a guy named Richard, okay? And Stephen now is calling me about Richard, right? He's not talking about his wife anymore. He's talking about Richard's wife. He's like, I cannot believe this guy. And what he tells me is that they, you know, they'd done some step work and they'd gone to a meeting. And they're outside in the courtyard during the break and they're eating like the birthday cake, you know, and the meeting's going on. And apparently Richard's wife found him. You know, I guess she put some kind of tracking device on his iPhone. I don't know what's going on, but she found him, went to the meeting, you know, accosted him in the meeting in front of the whole meeting, grabbed a plate of cake, slapped it up against his face. He's got cake all over his face, you know, and Stephen is talking about this. And I asked him, how are things going with your wife? He goes, pretty good. They're going pretty good. Now, it's not that we want to profit off of other people's misery, but it's just really interesting how that happens. And similarly, you know, like I had a real problem with sarcasm. I still have a problem with sarcasm, but when I was new, I was just wicked, vicious, awful. And I knew it was bad, and I'm writing inventory, and I'm talking to Michael about it, and I'm praying and meditating, and I'm asking God to remove this from me because, you know, you clearly don't enjoy it, and I'm feeling bad about it. But it's just so damn tasty, you know? And what happens is I'll be good for like a month or so, and then somebody will say something, and I just can't not do it. Now, and I'm praying and meditating, and I'm, you know, I'm asking God to remove it, and it's really not happening in the time frame that I think it should happen, and I'm embarrassed because I got to make amends every single time. Now, over time, instead of 3 comments, I'm down to 2. Then I'm down to 1. Then I get a guy that I sponsor that is the most sarcastic son of a bitch I've ever seen in my life. And he starts writing inventory to me about this, and amazingly, my problems curtail dramatically. He's struggling with this. He gets a guy, coincidentally, that he starts sponsoring, who is the most sarcastic SOB you've ever seen in your life. I mean, Dale and I were talking about this. Like attracts like. There's some type of energy that's within us that we put out, where I attract the guy who's got the kid with cerebral palsy. You know, I got marital problems, I attract the people who have marital problems. You know, there is something about that. There is something about us where this happens. And, you know, like I said, to me, where it really congeals and when it's really kind of all coming true is when you have that moment, when you have that conversation with a sponsee and you realize that neither one of us are talking about ourselves. We're talking about the other person. And to me, that is a form of the conscious contact. That's a form of the union. That's a form where there is no separation between me and you and me, and us and God. Let's take one break and we'll do final short session.